extremely slightly damp cloth and rub the great big ball on the Van de Graaff generator to get rid of the dust particles that settled on it. The dust particles represent a whole lot of sharp little points that do microscopic discharge, and the machine never builds up a voltage. Anything with high voltage on it has got to be very smooth and rounded. Otherwise, any little turbulence, any little sharp points anywhere will be a point of corona discharge. So if I've got the right kind of wiring between the Wimshurst machine and this electrostatic voltmeter, with everything very well insulated, great big round connections everywhere, I think the machine will still charge. But I haven't done that experiment. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm very well aware of the sharp point action, because when we worked on the 125 kV stuff and things like that, everything had to be ball soldered. And then these little rubber cups, or they were probably silicone, were put over them. And if you left one little spot out, you could blow that bus bar up in an instant, without a doubt. Very, very important. And I assume that you would have to have two balls the same diameter to be able to get an accurate reading as you back away. So that's another thing to consider, I would imagine.
In order to make it thoroughly predictable, yes. But I think I can calibrate it, though, John, by having direct connection, bringing it up to 30 kilovolts, then backing off to a known amount of... Uh-oh. I see a problem. I was going to back off until it read half voltage. As I back away, I'm changing the capacitance, which is going to be building up the voltage. Mother Nature's going to be fighting us on this one, John. I know there's an answer, but it's not simple. Over to you.
Yeah, we have to find out what that error is going to be. As you reduce the capacitance, you're going to get a certain increase, just what we were speaking about before. But interesting. And I'm sure there's a way to do it. And they probably do make an instrument that can handle it at a more reasonable price than what I've been looking at. But some of the scientific stuff is very expensive for what you're getting out of it. And how often am I going to use it? You know, a couple of times a year when I'm fooling around with it. So it really doesn't pay to spend that kind of money.
I highly agree with you. I wouldn't spend that much. And by homebrew means, you can do some of this work. There's ways you can buy a very inexpensive electroscope. And by the way, don't buy the electroscope from Science First. It's very low in sensitivity. I'm trying to remember where I bought this Chinese-made one that's green in color. Very sensitive. I'm talking about a 50-to-1 difference in sensitivity of an electroscope. So there are ways you can calibrate an electroscope. And you and I, when we're measuring high voltage, if we get an indication of 50 kilovolts and it's really 43 kilovolts, 45 kilovolts, to me, that's close enough for what I'm doing right now. It doesn't have to be that exact. I'm not willing to spend great big bucks for that.
The electroscope you have, is it gold leaf?
Yes, gold leaf, green-colored metallic sides, glass on front and back. I wish I knew where I bought it, but it's very sensitive. But the one sold by Science First, which looks like an Erlenmeyer flask with it's a roundish looking black thing, but the leaves inside are very heavy by comparison to the gold leaf. The gold leaf electroscope is very sensitive. I'll eventually find out where I bought it from so you can get the same brand name if you want to.
Yeah, that would be good if you could do that. I've seen the ones that look like the radiometer, and those don't work as well. I know that. I wouldn't buy one of those. They're like the cheap, high school science class or something. But the square ones that I've seen, that's probably the type that you have. So when you get that model number or whatever, I'll probably get one of those.
I eventually bought two of them. And they weren't very expensive. My vague recollection is like $20 a piece or something like that. The Volta's Hailstorm, as I remember, was like $38, a little bit pricey for what you're getting. But it's very nicely built. As I said, I think I bought it from Science First. I'll have to double check on that one. I have to look at my old receipts on these things. When you brought the magnets nearby, you expected the spark to be deflected, and there was no deflection at all. I've got a guess as to what's going on, and that is, if real current was flowing through the air, then the current would tend to be deflected. But the starting event that ionizes the air, the cosmic rays or whatever, they don't represent a normal current flow. They represent a charge motion. And does a charge particle moving in a magnetic field get deflected? The answer is yes. Huh. If it really is cosmic rays that initiate the event that gives you the arc, the cosmic rays don't give a darn about your and my magnetic field. And if they ionize a particular path and then you get an arc across that path, the arc itself does represent a current flow. So why doesn't the arc start flowing and then get deflected? You saw no deflection of any kind, no matter where you put the magnets. And where did you locate those magnets, John? Go ahead.
Okay, the magnets, I used the ones that were the size of a quarter, and I had a whole stack of them. I brought it as close to the middle of the arc that I could get to without it arcing actually to the magnets and using that as a conductive path. And it did not, it was imperceptible. If there was any deviation, I couldn't tell. And then I had done it 20 or 30 times, and there was no effect. Then I put it underneath the arc, on top of the arc. I was going to try to put a magnet on both sides and try opposing poles and attracting poles, but the damn magnets are so strong, they pull together even when they're like 3 inches apart, so I have to build some kind of device to hold them. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead, Wes.
Well, motion of particles in magnetic field, dF equals qvB. So the magnetic force on the moving electric charge is perpendicular to the velocity of charge. That means no work is done. And this is like a centripetal force in that it charges the direction of the velocity but does not charge the magnitude of the speed. So the kinetic energy remains the same and no work is done to the charge. If the charge is initially moving perpendicular to the magnetic field, then it will move in the circle in the plane perpendicular to the magnetic field. Now, what else I could say about the landing job? Okay. If the charge is not moving perpendicular to the magnetic field, it will continue to move in the direction to the magnetic field with constant speed in the direction. And while moving in a circular path around the magnetic field, the trajectory is called the helix. So that would be probably the explanation.
Inside of the gun of a old-fashioned cathode-ray tube television set, electrons are pouring off that cathode, being carefully focused, aimed at the center of the phosphor screen, a foot or two or 3 feet away. The yoke you've got around the neck of the tube is creating a deflecting, sawtooth-shaped magnetic field. And that sweeps the electrons left and right, top and bottom, to give you the raster scan. So, moving electrons, freely moving electrons in a vacuum inside the neck of a cathode ray tube do get deflected at right angles to the magnetic field. You, John, were creating a strong local magnetic field. When the arc occurred, you did have electrons flowing. Is that true? Let me think about that. Yes, I think you had electrons flowing. And the fact that you couldn't see them being deflected, and you were using really potent magnets. I presume in some of your experiments, you raised the magnets enough so that they were actually in the arc itself. And even then, you didn't see any effect of the magnets, did you, John? Go ahead.
No, Dick, I did. Let me let it drop. I brought them up from the bottom and from right and left with extension rods to the point where it used the magnet as a pad. Then, of course, you see it deflecting. But until that happened, nothing happened to that damn arc. But yet, now in the industry, I worked with 10,000 amp switches and 8,000 amps. We had magnetic snuffers. And when you put those on, you could actually see when the device or the armature pulled away from the contactor, you would see the arc move up on the chutes and snuff it. So I know it definitely affects this type of switch. Maybe there is not enough current to cause the issue, and maybe you're right. Maybe it's not electrons.
My gut feels it's got to be electrons, but I'm not sure. What else could there be? Yes, you're ionizing air molecules, and an ionized air molecule has a free electron in one direction and a nucleus of the rest of the molecule going in the other direction. There still are electrons flowing. However, the main portion of the arc is the flow from the positive probe toward the negative probe. So it's the heavy particles that are doing most of the flow during that event. And maybe it's a lot more difficult to deflect the heavy particles compared to the electrons. The charge to mass ratio is hugely different on the positive ions versus the negative ions in that arc. And I think it's the positive ions that are doing most of the flowing. Let me jump for a second. Did you get a chance to run the Wim Hof machine with the shorting bar between the two Leyden jars opened up so that now you have to move the probes closer together? There's very little current flowing, but you see a very different spark, and I wonder if you saw that air gap on what I think is the positive probe. Over to you, John, K2RAW.
Yes, Dick, I did do that, and you were right. When I disconnect that, you start to hear the hiss, even when they're 3 inches apart, but it does not complete an arc. And then when I adjust them, I could get a light arc. It was, if the arc path has a diameter, this diameter is 1/10 of the one when the bar is connected. But as far as detecting or discerning that space, that I was not able to do. I couldn't get the lab dark enough at the time. It was during the daytime. So I'm going to have to do that when it's dark. But I'm interested to see that too.
I have a question, but if you have the time for it.
Fire away. Wes, go ahead with your question.
I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt John, because John asked another question. So let John first finish that, and I'm going to be... I sent you a few emails, some of them entertaining, some of them quite scientific.
Go ahead, Dick. Take Wes's question.
One quick one for you, John. When you did put the magnet, one single magnet, right in the gap between the two probes, so that now it arced to the magnet on one side and from the magnet on the other side. Yes, the magnet is a metallic conductive object in the arc, and the arc will go straight to it and straight away from it. Was there any curvature of field in the vicinity of that magnet when it was placed in the arc? Over to you, John.
Dick, no, there wasn't, and I did that experiment at least 10 or 15 times, trying different positions and rotating it longitudinally or flat, and the arc was identical, straight across one pole to another through the magnet. It did not change the where it impinged on the magnet at all.
Did you try various orientations of the magnet? The magnet parallel to the Earth, perpendicular to the Earth, and so on? Over to you, John.
Yes, I did, Dick. I had it on a little piece of monofilament, and I would rotate it and raise it up and down while the arc was going on. It was like it wasn't even there except as a conductor.
Amazing. Huh. That's not an easy one to explain, is it? Because you've got a really potent magnet. You would think it would have to deflect that arc.
Well, that's what I believed. I would have put money on it, and it did absolutely nothing. Plus, my electrons are different over here.
Oh, I know what the problem is. Richmond has those blue electrons, not the red ones. That's the problem, John.
Yeah, well, something's going on, that's for sure. But I hope to get my film soon, so I'll be able to do some experiments with that. And by the way, Dick, I have a quick question. This week I acquired a new spectrum analyzer. It's new old stock, never been used. It's a Wavetech 1881, and that's not the year, that's the model number. I just wanted to know, have you ever used one?
I don't know if I've used a Wavetech. I don't think so. What's your guess as to the year of manufacture?
I think it was 1999. And I mean, it's pristine in the older wrappers. The only thing wrong with it is the lead acid battery that came with it. Of course, this is no, it's useless now, but what a gorgeous instrument, and it goes from 4 meg to 1 gig.
And I guess you said it's battery operated, so the lead acid battery needs replacement, and is that an easily obtained item?
I also got the power unit with it, which charges the battery and operates the unit if the battery would fail. So I don't even need to buy a battery for it. What a beautiful instrument this is. Very well made. It's got a ruggedized case, like a transport case, and a strap. It's about, I'd say, 16 inches in width and about 10 inches in height. It's got a nice 5-inch screen and works like a charm.
And once again, the battery was bad, but it's a commonly available battery. Is that what I heard you saying?
Yep, it's a 12-volt battery, a gel type, so anything that'll fit in there physically will run the machine.
It reminds me of what happens when I go to Sears Roebuck to buy a battery for my automobile. I measure the size of the battery case in the car, and then I go and look at all the batteries that get on the shelf with my ruler in hand. I choose one that'll just fill up that case, that has the maximum number of ampere hours or whatever, and I say, I want to buy that battery. To which they say, what kind of a car you got? To which I say, I'm not going to tell you. You're going to sell me that battery. Because you let them choose the battery that they think is appropriate for your car. They'll hand you some tiny little thing that fills up two-thirds of the space. And I don't like that. And they tell you if you put in the wrong battery that your whole electrical system is going to crash. Come on. I wonder if you ever run into that one, John. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. Whether it was my truck or my car with all the electronics equipment I had in there, I did the same thing you do. I even wound up putting an oversized rack in my car so I could put the largest battery that was made in the car. And, of course, you know, when they're doing cars, they're worried about fuel economy and all this stuff. And I just want a battery in there that I know has a lot of cranking amperes. And, yeah, I agree with you. You can't talk to those people.
Yeah, they've been programmed to think that if you don't use exactly the right brand name and model number of battery for your particular automobile, that it's gonna, that everything's going to explode. Okay, I'm looking at the first email you sent is labeled as a title TechNet. Is that the one I'm supposed to look at, Wes? Go ahead.
Correct.
Okay, and I'm now looking at the very first video, which is called Levitation, I think. Quantum Levitation.
It's correct. What it does, it shows the video courtesy from Association of Science Technology Centers in Tel Aviv, and it shows the demo of quantum semiconductor lab in magnetic fields. It does entertain a lot because he put the object on the disk that actually the disk wasn't moving, but he just moved that object and was going around, but then he tilted that object any other way and it was moving in that particular way. Now he took the object to his hand and put beneath that disk, and he snapped it to move it, and it was moving beneath the disk. So that's why I decided that it's an interesting subject.
Yes, I agree with you. I'm looking at that video right now. He has an array of about 9 square neodymium magnets at one end, and he's got a circular neodymium magnet on the other end. He's got the superconducting disk of material with what looks like snow on top of it. Somehow it's cryogenically cooled. Oh, yes, I guess that could be a chunk of dry ice on top. And I think one of your questions is going to be, why does it hold the position? In other words, when he's putting it over the square of 9 magnets, if he adjusts the height at high, low, tilt it to the left, tilt it to the right, no matter how he set it, it holds that position. Are you familiar with the phenomenon that causes that, Wes? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's lacking of the magnetic field, simply. Like the magnetic field is frozen. It cannot change, so the only what is very much entertaining in it, when he put it around the disc is in diameter probably about 2 foot, or maybe 3 foot disc, and he has a set of magnets, and then he push that object, it goes along that magnetic flex line. They are kind of frozen back to you.
Yeah, I'm seeing it going around that 3 foot diameter track, circular track right now. And that is cute, the way it magnetically locks. What's really happening, he's got a material that is partially superconducting when he, oh, now he's putting it underneath. When he pushes it to a particular position, he's forcing a certain magnitude of magnetic field into this partially superconducting material. If it was perfectly superconducting, he would never be able to lock it into a new position, if you know what I mean. But at 77 degrees Kelvin, which you get from dry ice, wait a minute now, is that the number you get from dry ice? Liquid nitrogen, boiling liquid nitrogen. Huh. Right now, I don't know what that snowy material is on top of his object. What do you believe that snowy material is, Wes? Go ahead.
Well, it looks like cryogenically cold, so that could be anything that is in within the region of cryogenic cooling. Any material at all. I mean, what is the material that is made from? It's a piece of material or fabric that is around something that is just holding in it. I mean, definitely it's light.
Yeah. I can boil off liquid nitrogen at room temperature, at room pressure, and it boils off at 77 kelvins. But that would be a liquid. Whatever he's got that makes that snowy appearance on top of his levitated object is a solid, not a liquid. And the fact that he can put it upside down tells me it's not just something in a cup. If you know, it's not a liquid in a cup. Dry ice is really carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide boils off at much too high a temperature to be cryogenic, to my knowledge. It's to give you superconductivity. I forget what the number is, but it's much too high. He's got to be under 100 kelvins for all the materials that I know about, which means he's got to be operating at liquid nitrogen. And right now I'm having trouble figuring out what is that snowy material, if you know what I mean, K2RAW.
Yeah, could that be moisture condensed from the air?
Yeah, the moisture is condensing on what? And the moisture, as it condenses from the air and goes from the gaseous state to the solid state, tremendous amounts of energy are being given off. Therefore, the object that's cryogenically cool would be heating up very fast. So there's some other source of cryogenicness that's a little bit of a mystery. Over to you, John.
Okay, no, just a thought. Back to you guys.
Okay, I think we don't have enough of time to go deep into the science. I have some other entertaining, but it's mostly scientifically entertaining, about the homework solution of magnetic fields and a lot of questions. One of them says, at the given instant, the proton moves in the positive x direction, and there's a diagram for it in the region where there is a magnetic field in the negative direction, z direction. What is the direction of magnetic force? Does the proton continue to move in positive x direction? I mean, all of these questions I believe we're going to leave for the next week, because it is interesting and entertaining, but we don't have much place for it. Now, what I would like to go to is the last image that I have sent you, and that relates to the 1896 Scottish physicist Charles Wilson, who was interested in the odd shadows that he sometimes was fall on cloud tops by Montes Clamber. So he was able to create a micro cloud in the glass jar. And I wonder if you ever came along that. He was analyzing the particle tracks and the fragileness of the structure, and trying to find out whether the saturation of the air inside with the humidity would hold that cloud. What he discovered is that when he let me jump, when he touches that glass jar, all of a sudden the cloud drops down. So I found that very much interesting, the way that he is trying to show the neutral particle proton transformation to negative charge that goes up and a positive charge that goes down.
Yeah, this article is called Lesson 46, Cloud and Bubble Chambers. Is that the one you're talking about? And how many paragraphs down does it talk about the track jumping down when you touch the cloud chamber? I guess there's an upper glass or plastic transparent surface, and he touches that with his finger, and then the trail jumps down. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. I believe it's page 17.1. Page 2 of 3, section 17.1, I was reading that I don't, the liquid as particles, a bubble chamber is always called bubble, magnetic field, this heaven because of magnetic force. I mean, magnetic force acting to the charged particles causes a certain centripetal pattern by simply measuring the radius of the path and I've got it. Both cloud and bubble chambers suffer from the drawback that they cannot detect neutral particles, since the ions only can cause the charge in the chamber. Instead, we have to look at the interaction of other particles with neutral. There was some very fragile structure about it. Now, on the page 3 of 3, you have the graph actually showing the neutral particle proton and the negative charge up and positive charge down. I found that also not very difficult to understand and very entertaining.
Yeah, I see that page 3, blue, negative charge up, red charge down, 8.55 millimeter radius from the transformation area that impact, I guess, took place. I haven't found the section yet that says that the trail jumps down when you put your finger on it.
Oh, hold on. The study for the holding the vapor. Okay. Air can usually only hold a certain amount of vapor. Supersaturated means that air was holding more vapor than it could normally be able to, and at that pressure and the temperature, it is in a very delicate state that can easily be disturbed to cause condensation of vapor into the liquid droplets, and that is on page 1, under the title Cloud Chambers, right beneath that, next to the picture of illustration 2. To be able, starts with the word, to be able to do this, he made his device so it could keep the air inside supersaturated with water.
Yeah, I'm reading that section right now. Yeah, I think in the very beginning, the Wilson cloud chamber was the best way of demonstrating the track that a particle out of an accelerator machine, where did they go and how did they behave? I think in the early days, the best way to visualize it was a Wilson cloud chamber. Is that true?
That is correct. I mean, we're talking about 1894. There was at a time in 1897, Nikola Tesla was doing his experiments with spark up building a wonder. I'm getting old. Wondercliff tower, and that was his end of the career because of. money of the financier of J.P. Morgan. Anyhow, very interesting material, and it's worth the effort of describing that better. and discuss on it. And then the other one that I have sent you, that would be also for the next week, I believe. It's interesting because it's entertaining. It's easy way to, and also all of the mathematical formulas are there. So.
Okay, when I get some time, I'll look at this. I'm going to have to leave you guys. Something I got to do tomorrow. That's pretty important to me. And so I better try to get some sleep tonight. You guys heard TechNet number 1,372 tonight. And
Before you go, okay, can I ask you one more question?
Go ahead.
Okay. I have just a few words. Diet recovery time. What diet the recovery time depends on?
Yeah, I think what we're talking about here is that when a diode has been forward biased and you try to instantaneously reverse bias it, current through the diode in the wrong direction will flow for a short period of time. And that's because there's an accumulated charge across the junction of the diode, and you have to drain away that accumulated charge. So I think you're sort of asking, what do you do to the design of the diode in order to make the recovery time, the T sub R.
For my project, I need the diodes that are very fast, diodes in switching. In other words, it's 100 picoseconds, nanoseconds. 100 nanoseconds is the time. Now, some of them, they have 500 nanoseconds that are slow, and that was the nature of the question. But another question is, how the inductance of the coil depends from the ferrite core.
Dick, what about a hot carrier diode or 2EO?
Yeah, those Schottky hot carrier diodes are very, very good along these lines. How do you lower the recovery time of a diode? The answer is to buy the right one. Because you and I are not going to build our own diode. So what really goes on inside to make the recovery time short? I don't really know. But buy the right one and that problem goes away. Now, when I looked at when I looked at his movie of the clear plastic box where he was lighting up 15 light bulbs, and he was initiating that with a 9-volt transistorized battery. What was that again?
It was TK.
Yeah, TK. Did you hear the very obvious 50-cycle hum when he first turned? Did you hear the very obvious 50-cycle hum when he first turned that machine on?
Yes, but it wasn't 50 cycles. It was for 38 cycles.
Also, the sparking that was going on inside of the plastic box when the machine was running steady state, the rate of sparking and the way the light bulbs were lit looked to me like they were almost unrelated.
Is correct.
Now, he did have some external wiring. One of his wires went to a water tap pipe, and he wrapped the wire around it. He did have two other what looked like power leads going into the box. What were those other two power leads doing?
Well, at first, he had a commissioner from the president, and he was... asked the question. Also, the member of the local university, he was asked to prove that he's only using the ground. So what he did is he said, okay, this is what I'm doing with the ground. I'm using the cold water pipe, and he put a probe on it. But I asked him to do independent tests, so he took the old radiator from the car, the copper one, he dug the hole, he put the water on it, and he closed the hole, and he attached the wire to it. So he said, okay, now we have a two of them. Now you can disconnect which one you want to. Back to you.
That may not be the same movie that I saw. The movie that I saw, the YouTube video, he was on two or three occasions lighting up the board with 15 bulbs, and each time he started it with the 9-volt battery...
That is correct.
Each time he started it with the 9-volt battery, there was a very heavy hum of some kind that slowly subsided. But the box that he was holding in the air, the clear plastic box, did have two other fairly high-power-looking wires going into it. Could you explain what those two wires were doing?
No. It was one wire that was that was the wire for the ground. There was no other wire into that. I gotta take a look at this, but definitely, Dick, I've seen it on my eyes. I hold it in my hands. There is no catch.
And so, I think you're saying he has demonstrated that to a number of people who accepted the demonstration, is what I think you're saying.
Yes. From all of the people, I am the guy who went to as close as possible to this guy. I don't believe there was anybody who came that close to this guy. And I can tell you one thing. I've seen it. I hold it in my hands. I examined the device as much as I could. DK wasn't present. He was sick in the bed. I was with the guy who assembled it, because he got sober for a short period of time. He said at 4 o'clock in Sunday, and I had a flight very early in the morning, that this device is supposed to be assembled specially for me. And I'm telling you, it's not a joke. 9-volt battery, one impulse, 200 watts, or 9-volt battery, one impulse and 5 kilovolts, or 12-volt battery, one impulse and 60 kilovolts, or 12-volt battery, one impulse, 100 kilovolts, and 2 ampere.
You had a chance to inspect the clear plastic box while he was sleeping. During that inspection, was it running then or not running then, Wes?
No. The material that I have sent you clearly states that I did not see the aquarium. It's being called aquarium. That is one that is showed for 5 kilowatts. I didn't see this one. I've seen 200 watts. 200 watts, one impulse, less than a second, or maybe close to the second. No external power supply of any kind. No power supply at all. And to XG.
Has one of those ever been brought out of his country to our country, to your knowledge, West?
No, but he asked me for the opportunity to do that and assemble it in here. And I don't want to go to the detail what happened, but I got sick in the plane. He got sick in the plane. He ate only 10% of the food that I ate. I went to the bathroom and threw away everything that was in me. I'm strongly convinced that I was poisoned, and to extreme.
Yeah, that is kind of significant. I'm going to have to leave you guys. I'll try to study some of this material, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, 7:30. Thank you very much. KC2WGB.
To extreme. John, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Can you go upstairs?
Yeah, sure. KC2WGB, QSY.
1 a.m. 73 and good night from the WQEL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30 WQEL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Welcome to the WQVL repeater.